speaker all the way from Fullerton. He had a very long drive. So let's give him a big South County welcome to Pat O.
All right. Someone already unmuted me. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here. I want to thank you for asking me to participate in my recovery. I want to thank my friends for making the drive with me. It's kind of interesting, this whole Zoom thing. You know what I mean? It's like I'm with 105, I think it was 104 new friends, right? And I'm in my living room. You know what I mean? It's just kind of funky. You know, I'm like I feel like I'm talking to myself. I had to definitely, as I mean, I am self-centered and I am self-obsessed, but I did move it from the screen. That's just me, you know, because that's weird, you know, just talking to myself. So, you know, I've creeped out a little bit, and some of you guys don't have your video on, which is, you know, even weirder. But some of you do, so I'm gonna stick with the people that have their video on so that I can try to get some sort of reaction. You know, you tell a joke and no one, you don't hear nothing. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of weird, but you know what? I'm really grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. What's really cool is like to see, like, cause I'm a doubter of this idea of God. You know what I mean? I mean, I have a deep, profound faith that comes and goes, you know? And to see, like, when all this happened, to see how fast Alcoholics Anonymous mobilized itself in order for us to be able to connect through Zoom, it's just been such a powerful experience. You know, I get to sit with my friend Carlos, who's in Texas. You know, I get to sit with him. My friends, who, you know, it is only, you know, what, 45 miles away in San Fernando Valley. You know, my friend Nick and his mom has one day, and my future wife, she's there too. But like, I don't get to see them all the time, but yet we get to sit together. You know, at 12 noon, I was in Ireland. I got to meet, you know, 55 friends from Ireland that I never met, you know, and like, how cool. Like, I would not have had that experience on, you know, May 2nd of 2020 if this wouldn't have happened. And so it's kind of cool to see the power of God come through the spirit of us as individuals, as alcoholics, you know, to come together so that we can connect on some level. And you know, I really am grateful. I have a heart of gratitude tonight as I sit here in my living room, you know, to be with you. And I want to thank you for asking me to come. I have a sobriety date, 10/23/02. I have a sponsor. His name's Mike Socchio. And I have a home group, and my home group's real similar name to you guys. It's the South Coast Speakers Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have people called it Gucci for a long time. It's in Laguna Beach. We meet on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. And I love my home group. You know, I remember being met by a man by the name of John Ackerland when I first showed up to my home group, and he had 40 something years of sobriety. And I'll never forget the softness of that man's hand. Because he put his hand out to me and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, kid." He said, "Come in with me." And he took me inside, and he back then we used to have donuts, and he gave me a donut and he gave me a cup of coffee, and he welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll never forget his unconditional love. He didn't care where I had been, who I had done it with, if I was a drug addict, if I was an alcoholic. He didn't care about anything. About any of that stuff. He brought me in to the second row, and he sat me in the middle of giants. And I'll never forget the old timers of my home group. But they've all passed away, and guys like Johnny Crean and Frank O'Rourke and Tommy Whalen. And I remember when I first got my first year of sobriety, and Tom Whalen, he said, "Oh, great job, kid." He's like, "You're still a newcomer until you get 5 years." And I was like, "Oh, okay." You know what I mean? And then I got 5 years, and he said, "Hey, good job, kid." He said, "You're new until you get 10 years." And I'm like, "Okay, you know." And then I get 10, and he goes, "Good job, kid. You're new till you get 15." You know, I was like, "All right, you know." And that, now I'm a slow learner, but I knew when I was gonna go, you know, I knew he's gonna tell me. But then he passed away, you know what I mean? So I've just taken on as, I guess I'm always gonna be new. And then the birthday guy tonight says, "I'm a newcomer." I forgot his name. "Happy birthday." He said, "I'm a newcomer, 54 years." You know what I mean? I'm like, there it is. And I know for me, you know, what I believe spiritually is that Tom Whalen's spirit talked through you tonight to let me know that I'll be forever new here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't ever want to think that I'm somebody around here. I want to continue to seek on a daily basis. You know, I suffer from alcoholism. I suffer from a mind that tells me I don't have it. You know what I mean? I know that I have alcoholism today, and I know that my disease is progressive. Though I've been sober 17 years, my disease is still progressively moving. You know, and I know today that my spiritual life needs to continue to progress as well, so that when those thoughts come, that I have a defense against that first drink, because there's no power. There's no power, that there's never been a power, physical power, that's been able to stand in between me and that first drink ever. And, you know, and I'm forever grateful for the old timers, you know, and I just hope that I can carry that same message of unconditional love that they gave to me in those beginning days, you know, and the unconditional, you know, because I was like, I know that I have a nervous disposition. The big book talks about this nervous disposition. I know that I had that nervous disposition, but when I was brand new, like I couldn't sit still. I was just like, like vibrating, you know what I mean? And I would be sitting in the middle of these guys. It was an hour and a half meeting, and John would put his hand on my leg and he'd say, "Don't forget to breathe, kid." You know, it's like, okay, breathe, you know. You know, don't forget to breathe. And then I got my anxiety, so I got to get up and go, you know. And he would put his hand on my leg and he'd say, "We don't get up during the meeting." You know, I was like, all right, I guess I got to sit here, you know. And he says, "You go to the bathroom before the meeting and you go after," you know. And I remember the next week or week, two late weeks later or something, the leader came up to me and she was like, "You know, what's your name?" I said, "Oh, I'm Pat." And she said, "I would love for you to read the 12 traditions. Will you read?" And John goes, "He's not reading." My feeling was hurt. You know what I mean? I was like, why can't I read? And he said, "Because he's not dressed appropriately to get behind the podium." He said, "If you want to read next week, show up with a collared shirt, kid." And I was like, okay, you know. And so the next week I showed up with a collared shirt. Then they didn't even ask me to read. You know what I mean? I was like, then I was like resentful and I was pissed off, you know, but it was just that simple spoon fed message of how to respect the thing that was going to save my life, you know? And I didn't know that at the time, you know, he got me into the history. He gave me Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. He's like, "You have a hard time sleeping, kid, read this book." And I was like, all right, you know, and I don't know about you, but I read like one page of a history book and I'm sleeping, you know, but I'll be forever grateful, you know. But I'll tell you, that wasn't my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 11 months old. You know, I didn't have a drinking problem, but my mom did, you know, and my mom was being sentenced to prison for 10 years or go to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mom sat in the courtroom and she thought about it. She's like, "Prison for 10 years or AA? Prison for 10 years or and the attorney's like, "Hey, you should probably go to AA, you know what I mean? And so my mom went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mom's a blackout drinker, you know. Well, which means I'll never know who my dad is, you know. For all I know, my dad could be the cable guy. It's like bow now, you know, like a dirty porno flick, you know. And mom didn't know she was pregnant till she was in labor, you know what I mean, which is even really more weird, you know. She thought she was constipated, so she called 911. I guess because that's what you do when you're constipated, you call 911. And she gave birth, and the paramedics holding me. And I have a picture of the paramedic holding me in front of the fire engine when I was a kid, infant. But the paramedic was holding me, and he's like, "You need to name your kid." And my mom's like, "What? Name what?" And my mom's name was Patty, so she named me Patrick, so she wouldn't forget my name. You know what I mean? You know, it doesn't make me alcoholic. It just makes for an awkward story to tell here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But I know that I have a spiritual malady. Like, I know that I have a disconnect between me and you. I didn't know that at the time. But the best way to describe myself as a kid is, like, I'm like the little kid in elementary school that smells like poopy pants and syrup. You know what I mean? I'm, like, weird. I'm awkward. You know, I'm a right fielder on the baseball team. I don't know if there's any other right fielders here. It's hard to see you guys, you know. But I know no one's going to admit it, you know. It's like the loser position, you know what I mean? I throw the ball as hard as I can that way. It goes like 5 feet that way, you know. And I'm in right field. I'm resentful at the pitcher. He's usually the coach's son. I'm like, "Oh, man, I hate that guy. He gets all the playing time. He gets all the attention. You know, I know there's something wrong with me. And I probably would have been diagnosed with ADD. I mean, they weren't dishing out the pellets back then, you know what I mean? But I'm like in left field looking for the long grassing with the white thing on there. And somebody told me that if I found one of those things and blew off all those white little things, I can have a wish. You know what I mean? And the coach is yelling at me. He's like, "The other side of the field, kid." I'm like wishing for a different life out left field, you know. Like my mode of operation is self-pity, you know. And, you know, I grew up in AA. Like, I was raised with a lot of love. Being not having a dad doesn't make me alcoholic. You know? But I remember looking out the window of my bedroom, wondering if my dad was ever going to come home. And I knew inside that I wasn't lovable. I knew my own father didn't want me. I didn't have the vocabulary to say that I had a spiritual malady. I didn't have the vocabulary to say I had a spiritual disconnect. You know, my mom, my grandma would take me to church, and my grandma would hoot and holler and dance and do the deal, and I'd wonder what was wrong with me. Like, I'm listening to the same message, listening to the same music, and I'm not feeling that same connection that my grandma was feeling. And I knew that there was something wrong with me as a little kid, you know. But like the love that I feel in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was the love that I was raised with. You know, my first memory, I remember stealing 15 packs of sugar and standing outside the meeting sucking down sugar. And you know, the women in AA were like, he's so cute, can I have him for the weekend? And my mom would be like, sure, go ahead, you know. And women would take me whitewater rafting in San Francisco, and they spoiled the heck out of me is what they did. And I met some of these women today, and they're like, oh, my mom, oh, my God, your mom let me have you when I had 7 days sober, you know. And I don't know, maybe AA was different back then, but I knew what alcoholism did. I watched a woman die of this disease in my mom's living room. Every meeting, after the meeting, my mom and her friends would take it, the newcomer, and they'd take her to Denny's, and they'd drink coffee with her and keep her there till 2:15 in the morning, and then they let her go. And I'd pass out at Denny's all the time with them. And I knew what recovery was. I knew what alcoholism did to people. You know, but I took my first drink of alcohol. I was 9 years old. I was at an AA meeting of all places, you know. I mean, I was with my mom at an AA meeting. I was 9. These other kids were 14. And we ran around the meeting, and we ding-dong-ditched the same doorbell. And the guy would chase after us. And he'd chase after us into AA. And we'd hide amongst you. And the guy would be like, where's those damn kids? And the people from AA would be like, there's no kids here. And you guys taught us how to con and lie and manipulate you know, but I was at the Laguna Beach Hospital. The meeting started at 8 o'clock, 45 minutes ago, and meeting still goes on today. And we'd mess around with this guy. He was a chronic relapser. He stood outside the meeting. He sucked cigarettes down. He was pissed off. And I didn't know he was a chronic relapser at the time, but I know now, but he was angry. And so we'd mess with him, and he would chase after us. And I threw a little pebble at him like I always threw, messed with him, and he chased after us. So we ran through the hospital, and we ran outside the front door. My heart was pounding. And the day before, my mom talked to me about drinking and doing drugs. And I made my mom that promise. I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to do drugs. My mom was my hero. I love my mom more than anything. I meant that promise. And we ran outside that hospital. And we ran out to the parking structure and ran up the stairs. And we were between the third and the fourth story of this parking structure. And these kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I didn't know what alcohol would do to me or for me. But I knew inside myself that if I didn't drink it that day, those kids weren't going to like me. And the bottle went back around. And the second time, because the first time I drank that tequila, I spit it out. And the second time I got that bottle, I was excited about having some friends. You know, my whole life, I had friends, but I was always on the outside looking in. You know, I never felt connected to anybody. I never felt connected to any group of friends. I always felt like the outcast, you know, and I took that bottle of tequila and I drank that stuff, and it held it down. And I didn't get drunk that day, but I can tell you the exact effect that alcohol has on this alcoholic body was all that fear went away. Like right in that moment, I seemed to like connect to those kids in that moment. Like all of a sudden I felt a part of them. And all of a sudden, like they started telling me things like I had an old soul, you know, and like, I don't know if that was like their justification to keep me around or whatever, but I had an old soul and I could relate and I could like hang with the old kids. And, you know, 11 years old, I took my first hit of weed. This little elf chased me around the park, and I quickly equated that parents lie, authority lie, teacher lie. Because everybody told me that if I smoke weed, bad things are going to happen, and nothing bad happened to me. And I stopped going to AA with my mom, and I started to drink and smoke weed as often as I could. And by the time I was a freshman in high school, I was drinking every weekend and smoking weed every day. And my mom would go speak in Idaho for some conference, and I'd steal her truck and have a party. And And I was just an absolute train wreck. And what happens for little poopy pants when I drink alcohol? I listen to like gangster rap and I wear a size 50 Dickies pulled all the way up. And I wear a 5XL sweatshirt and I drink St. Ives in my brown paper bag and I pour beer in the curb for the dead homies. And because alcohol gives me power, right? Like alcohol gives me this self of this like sense of confidence. It gives me this, like, it takes away all that fear. It removes little poopy pants and gives him some sort of power. And I didn't know that alcohol was a solution for me at that time. I didn't have the story to tell you until I got here and heard my story. I didn't have the words, you know? But that was what was going on. And my mom was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her kid would come home and come out of a blackout, peeing all over her house and went, you know, sneaking out the door and sneaking out of my bedroom and running away and bringing runaway kids home into my mom's house. You know, I was 17 years old, and my mom, she found a bag of weed in her house, and my mom was like, hey, like, I'm an active member of AA. Like, you, if you want to live at home, like, you have to be sober. Like, you can't, you know, I'm not going to let you bring alcohol and drugs into my home. Like, you need to figure that out. Like, if you want to live here, you got to be sober. And if not, then you got to go. And I didn't hear that, like, really. Like, what I heard was that I had to hide it better. You know what I mean? Like, stopping wasn't an option. Like, I had to hide it better, you know? And so I just said, oh yeah, mom, I understand. And then I hid it better, so mom couldn't find it, you know? And I was already trying to control and enjoy my drinking at 17 years old, though I didn't know it at the time, you know? And I would drink just a little bit just so that I didn't black out. And I wouldn't drink hard alcohol, but I could drink beer. One night I overshot the mark and I came home and I was coming in out of a blackout and I was kind of just holding on and I was like, whoa, you know what I mean? And the top lock was locked and I knew my mom was upset. I was like, dang, I think I pissed her off. And so I rang the doorbell and I'm trying to pull it together. Like, I got it all down, you know, and I ring the doorbell and my mom comes to the door and she's standing there and she found a bag of weed in her hand. And my mom looked at me and she said, I told you if I found this stuff again, I was going to have to kick you out. Now, that's what I heard, right? I heard that I was kicked out of the house. When I walked in my bedroom, I packed my backpack, and I walked by my mom at 17 years old, and I looked at her right in the eyes and said, I'm going to do everything I can to ruin your life. And I literally watched my mom's heart break right in that moment. And I don't know how you deal with shame and guilt, but this alcoholic arrogance came out. I puffed my chest. I grabbed my mom by the collar. I slammed her up against the wall, pounding up against the wall. F you. I hate you. You're never going to see me again. And my mom, I love my mom more than anything. My mom was my hero. And alcohol was making decisions for me at 17, because what my mom said that night, she said, you can stay here and be sober or go out on those streets and get loaded, but you need to make a choice. Alcohol told me that I was kicked out. Alcohol made that choice for me. Alcohol told me to put my hands on my mom, and I didn't call my mom for a year and a half. And I left my mom there to worry and pay for that decision. I called my mom a year and a half later, and I had gotten in an accident. I was living in San Francisco, and I had gotten in an accident. I called my mom. I said, Mom, I got in an accident. I need to go to the hospital. I don't know what to do. And my mom said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. What can I do for you? She was terrified. She was going to get the call that her son bled out, you know? I said, I don't know how I'm going to pay for this hospital. And she's like, well, why don't you just give me an address to the hospital and I'll send them a check. And I said, oh, no, Mom, they need cash. Her mom was like, I don't know how I'm going to give you cash. Like, you're in San Francisco and I'm in Orange County. And I said, well, there's this thing called Western Union. It's right down the street from your work. And you just head on down to that little liquor store and you pay them the money. And then I could pick it up here. And my mom was so scared that her son was going to bleed out. She was going to get the call that I overdosed and died. My mom was so scared. She ran out of that liquor store and wired me the money just like that. And a week later, I had this bright idea. I was like, oh my God, I got another accident. And I called my mom, collect, and she would wire me the money just like that. And this would go on for the next 10 years. I was homeless from 17 till I got sober at 27 years old. In 2000, I went to treatment. When I was a little kid, my mom put me in the YMCA. I was a camper, and then I became a counselor in training. And then I'd show up to camp and I'd be like, hey, you know, and I'd be like you know, coming off LSD and ecstasy and drinking the night before. And I was like, hey, I'm your camp counselor, you know, and you drop your kids off to me. And I was just an absolute wreck. And I had become an assistant director for a YMCA program up in San Francisco after school program. And I was drinking and doing drugs on a daily basis. And I showed up to camp one year and the director looked at me and said, you need to get on that boat and get the heck out of here. We don't want you here. And the only good thing I had in my life was gone. And I remember getting off that boat and picking up the phone and calling my mom. And I said, Mom, I need help. And I knew something was wrong, you know. And my mom said, I'll take you to one treatment center and that's all you get. And so my mom took me, and I'm a Betty Ford. Eileen, thank you for your 10 minute talk. I'm a Betty Ford alum too. I went to Betty Ford. I went in August in Palm Springs though. You know what I mean? And I had like long johns on, pants, sweatshirt, beanie, like freezing in the middle of August in Palm Springs, you know what I mean? 130 degrees. And I was just like, but alcohol wasn't my problem. You know, I had a drug problem. I had a heroin problem. And it's a medical model, and I don't understand what they're talking about. And there's no fraternizing. So I wrote a girl a letter, and 28 days later, we fell in love. You know, we never even had a conversation, you know, but we fell in love. And I'm in love with this girl, and my counselor's like, you got to do a 9-month program. And so I wrote her a note, and I was like, where should we go to sober living? And she's like, let's go to Hawaii. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so great. You know, romance. We had the same sobriety day. We went to the same treatment center. Like, this is totally God's will. Like, and I believed it. Like, I truly believed that I had come to find God in treatment. I truly came to believe that I was making a decision to turn my will and life over to God. No, I didn't know it was her. And so, you know, I got on the plane to go to Hawaii, and if you're a drug addict, alcohol is not a problem. So when the flight attendant asked me what I wanted to drink, I ordered a Heineken. And 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii. Now, I didn't hear anything about an allergy or, you know, phenomenon. I didn't know it was the first drink that gets you drunk. I didn't know anything like that. You know what I mean? I heard about a frontal lobe cortex. I don't understand that. So I just, oh yeah, frontal lobe cortex. And I got off the plane. I stood there that day and I thought, sober living or bar? Sober living or bar? Not knowing that when I put the first drink in, alcohol is going to make choices for me. Here I am thinking I'm making a choice. Not knowing what that when I put the first one in, the second one was going to tell me exactly what to do. I had no idea. I said, man, I'll go to sober living tomorrow. You know, and it took me another year and a half till I got sober, and I'd go in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd say, are there any newcomers? And I'd raise my hand and I'd say, yeah, my name is Pat and I'm an addict. Oh man, don't say that in AA, man. Everyone's like, oh, there's an addict in our room. Let's get him out of here. You know what I mean? He's going to infest AA, you know? And I leave AA and I flip you guys off, and no one ever followed angry guy out the door and said, hey kid, here's a big book of AA. Maybe you might have alcoholism, not knowing what alcoholism is. And I go out there and I die. And I come back to AA and I wouldn't identify because I didn't want the judgment from you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd go out there and I'd die. And I would come to, you know, and then I'd come to the meeting and are there any newcomers? And by this time I could get down with the Andas, you know what I mean? I was part of the Anda crew, you know what I mean? So I was like, oh yeah, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic and addict. And you know how they are in AA, man. Oh, put $2 in the basket. Ha, 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 you know. You know, laughing at the stupid newcomer in the back of the room who doesn't know how to identify around here. The guy who doesn't understand what the singleness of purpose or the anything about the 12 traditions, you know. And I go out there and I die. And no one ever followed me out of the room and said, hey, kid, my name's Bob. You want to go to Denny's? Let me tell you my story. I already identified my alcoholism at 17 years old. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't have the vocabulary to tell you what was wrong with me. And I'm so grateful for the responsibility statement around here that says when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. I have a responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that when I meet a new man, to take that new man from the blank page to page 43 and identify my alcoholism. And that if he's an alcoholic, that we have a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous for you. But it is still my responsibility as a member of AA to know another member in a different fellowship that if he's not alcoholic, I could put his hand in the hand of someone that can help him. Because God brought him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came out of a blackout. I was physically and sexually assaulted, blood come every hole in my body. I looked around the bathroom. There was no clothes. There was no towel. I knew I had to go down the hallway of shame. I walked down the hallway. I was shaking violently. There was three dudes on a couch. I didn't know who they were. There were some clothes that looked like mine, and I went over there and I put them on. I went outside. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The sun was bright, and across the store, across the street was a store, and there was a liquor. It just said liquor, liquor, and it was the brightest light ever, man. And I was filled with so much shame and so much guilt and remorse and fear and loneliness. And I knew that if I could get in there and get a pint of tequila, everything would be all right. I get in there and I put that pint of tequila and drunk, you know. And I came to, I had called a guy from AA, though I didn't know. And I came out of a blackout, and there were, it was a camp out, an AA camp out. And there was a guy with 44 years, and he was shaking my hand. And he was giving me a big book, and they were all welcoming the newest guy to AA. And if you've been to an AA camp out or a convention, I was the newest newcomer at the countdown. You know what I mean? Coming out of a blackout, man, I wanted to punch this old guy right in the mouth, you know? And I was full of anger, man. I was like, last place I want to be is AA. And this little old lady named Myrtle came up to me. And she said, hi, my name's Myrtle. And her softness and love touched my heart. She said, come with me, kid. And she walked me off. And she over there by like where the food is. And she said, we're going to be a service. And I'm thinking, no, we're not, Myrtle. She said, yeah, we're going to serve ice cream at the ice cream social. And I'm thinking, no, we're not, Myrtle. But I have a character defect that I want you to like me. So I go, okay, sounds great, Myrtle. And she gives me the scooper and the good folks from AA come. And I'm like, well, like the ice cream's falling. I'm shaking, coming out. I'm shaking and the ice cream's going everywhere. And she goes, I have a better job for you, kid. She said, come with me. She takes me off to the side and she gives me a trash bag and she grabs a trash bag and she goes, you just do what I do, kid. And she grabbed a piece of trash and she put it in her bag. And I grabbed a piece of trash and I put it in my bag. And she picked up a piece of trash. And for the next 30 minutes, we picked up trash at that camp out. And we sat down on this log and she looked at me and she said, how do you feel, kid? And I looked at her and I said, for the first time in a long time, I haven't thought about drinking. She said, you're always welcome here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if service was enough, I'd have never picked back up. That guy dropped me off at that same liquor store. I walked in, I got a pint of tequila, drunk just like that. I manipulated my mom to get me back to the mainland. The last year and a half of my drinking was downtown LA and Skid Row. My mom had gone to Al-Anon, so the money stopped coming, you know what I mean, which sucks, you know. She started saying no, you know, no's a full sentence. Oh, God. I'm going to set a boundary. Oh, God. And I would say things like, Mom, if I only had a dad, I wouldn't be in this situation. And sometimes I'd hit that guilt button and she'd wire me the money. I'd tell her how much I loved her and a great mom she was, and I'd hit that sensitive button and she'd wire me the money. But the money stopped coming when I was living on Skid Row and my hustle started getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And as a straight man, I'd walk into a gay bar and I'd flirt with enough men to get enough alcohol in my body and hope that I'd make it out before I blacked out. And sometimes I would and sometimes I wouldn't. And I would come to in a motel physically assaulted, sexually assaulted. And I'd leave the motel and I'd just be shaking violently. And I knew that if I could just get to that liquor store and get a pint of tequila, everything would be all right. It'd be 5:30 in the morning. I make a promise. I'm not going to go back to that motel. I'm not going to do those same things I was doing. It'd be 5:30 in the morning. I'd sit there shaking violently, waiting for the liquor store to open at 6 in the morning. I'd walk in there. I get a pint of tequila. I take that cap. Twist that thing. Throw it off because you don't need a cap when you're drinking a pint of tequila. And I'd drink. Don't. And all that shame and all that guilt and all that fear would go away. And all of a sudden, I'd have that confidence that this time I'm going to go to school and this time I'm going to get a job and this time everything is going to be all right. But not knowing that I suffered from alcoholism, not knowing that what happened to me And I'd be back down the street doing those same things I was doing that I promised myself I wouldn't be doing. Back at that same motel, knocking on the door to go back in, doing the same thing, coming to the next morning, same situation, shame and guilt, remorse. Back at that liquor store, promising myself I'm not going to do it. Time in and time out, not knowing what was wrong with me. And when I came to on October 23rd, 2002, I was laying in bed with a dude. I had no clue who he was, but knew what I did the night before in order to get what I needed to get. Same feelings of shame, guilt, remorse, fear, isolation, loneliness. But I had a spiritual defense that walked me in right in between me and that first thought of that first drink. And that spiritual defense said, call your mom and ask for help. I know that God worked in my life that day, though I didn't believe in God until I was 10 years sober. I called my mom and said, Mom, I need help. And my mom said, I can't help you anymore. She said, stay right where you are and someone from Alcoholics Anonymous will come and get you. So if I come and get you, I'm gonna end up killing you. And she hung up on me. And I know that my mom would have came one more time, I would have manipulated her for 20 more bucks. I can guarantee I wouldn't be staying here tonight. And I was on the edge of this bed in this motel, shaking violently. I was 98 pounds. Had been up for 21 days. I was absolutely crazy. Talked to myself. And these two guys, man, that my mom called every high profile old timer because she wanted the best guy to help her kid, you know. And not one of them answered. But the guy that answered the phone with one ring. He had a year of sobriety and he was on fire for AA, man. He was like, where's the kid at? I'll go get him. You know what I mean? And my mom gave him the address. He went and picked up a new guy and they showed up and they didn't even knock when they got there. They just barged right through that motel door. They go, my name's Jack and I'm an alcoholic. My whole body was like vibrating. And this other guy was on a walker. He's like, my name's John. I got 90 days sober. You know what I mean? I was like, oh my God. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking, man, I just entered lameness. And here I am judging the good folks that came for fun and for free. See, I have to judge you to keep you at an arm's distance. If I let you in, you're going to hurt me like everyone else has hurt me my whole life. I know the power of God came into my life because Jack said, come with me, kid. And I got off that bed and I followed that guy at that motel. I was sexually assaulted 12 times by the time that guy got there that day. I never met my man, my dad, and I've never trusted men my whole life. And I got off the bed and I followed that guy out of there. And we're standing in front of a van. He goes, kid, if you need to throw up, he's like, just throw up on the floor. Don't worry, it's a 12-step van. You know? John's all laughing. And I got in the van and Jack told me a story. If you're new here tonight, Alcoholics Anonymous is a storytelling society. We come here and we tell our story. And Jack started telling me his story. He talked about every time he drank, he went to the hospital and John was in the seat going, ha, 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 ha. All this one time I drank and I went to the hospital and John's all, ha, 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 ha. All this other time I drank and I went to the hospital and John's all, ha, 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 ha. And I'm sitting here going, man, I don't go to the hospital. And I didn't say this, but in my head, I'm thinking, I don't go to the hospital. And then all of a sudden Jack goes, hey John, when you drink, what happens? And John goes, oh man, this one time I drink and I went to the hospital and John was all, and Jack was all, ha, 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 ha. And this other time I drink and I went to the hospital and Jack's all, ha, ha, ha. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is just crazy. You know what I mean? Like these guys drink and they go to the hospital and I don't drink and I don't go to the hospital. And before you knew it, I ended up at a place called Charlie Street. And they put me on the couch and they said, sit down and shut up, kid. And Jack goes, kid, when you drink, what happens to you? I said, I don't go to hospital. He goes, where do you go? And I go, I go to jail. And neither of them laughed. And I was like, you know, okay. And he goes, hey, Pete, come on over. Meet new guy, Pat. And this guy, Pete, comes wallowing all over. And Jack goes, hey, Pete, when you drink, what happens to you? And Pete goes, oh, man, this one time I drank and I went to jail. And I went, ha, 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 ha. And then all of a sudden he told me this other story. He drank and he went to jail. And he drank and he went to jail. And I'm sitting over there laughing and I'm laughing. And all of a sudden I say, oh man, this one time I drank and I went to jail too. And Pete goes, hey, Fred, come on over, meet new guy Pat. And then all of a sudden Fred's there and Fred drinks and he goes to jail and Pete goes to jail and I go to jail. And then Bob comes over and Bob goes to jail and we're all going to jail and we're laughing and we're drinking and we're like, woo, we go to jail. Yeah. And we're identifying with one another. Now, though I didn't know it, we were identifying. I didn't know what was going on. This is what was going on. And then all of a sudden, Jack came over and saw our egos through the roof. And he goes, yeah, you go to jail? I said, yeah. He goes, why do you pick back up? I said, I have no idea. And he started to tell me the thinking that always preceded his first drink. And he started telling me all these stories. And I said, Jack, I said, man, you won't believe it. I go, man, when I go to jail, my mom comes and sees me and she looks at me in the glass and I make a promise I'm not going to drink to her. And I mean it with everything in me. And then H&I comes. And if you do H&I, keep doing H&I because you'd give me hope. And I would connect with you. And then I go to church on Sunday trying to find God. And I'm making a promise and I'm never going to drink. I'm going to get out of jail. This time it's going to be different. And like right before, about an hour before I get out, I start having a conversation with myself, Jack. Jack goes, really, what did the conversation say? So, well, the conversation always started off with, Pat, alcohol is not your problem. If you just don't do heroin, everything's going to be all right. So I get out of jail and I go to the 7-Eleven. I get a 12-pack of beer. I drink one beer down. Shame, guilt, remorse goes away in the middle of the second beer. Jack, I said, something happens, but I'm down the street. And all before you know it, I meet a new friend. Before you know it, I'm back in jail. He said, what happened that time? I said, well, my mom came and saw me and I'm making a promise I'm not going to drink. I'm going to change my life. H&I comes. I'm connected. I find God. I find Jesus. I turn my life and over in jail. And about an hour before I get out, I start having a conversation with myself. He said, what did the conversation say that time? And I said, Jack, you won't believe it. I said, alcohol's not your problem, Pat. If you just don't smoke crack cocaine, everything will be all right. So I get out of jail. I go to that 7-Eleven. I get a 12-pack of beer. I drink one beer. Shame, guilt, remorse goes away in the middle of the second beer. I'm down the street. He said, really? You're down the street? I said, yeah, man. I was down the street. I met a new friend. We're in a motel for like 7 days, butt naked. He said, you were? I said, yeah. He said, what happened? I said, I was arrested. And Jack goes, ha, 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 ha. Oh, man. He started laughing, and I started laughing, and all of a sudden, that shame that I felt started to lessen. And he looked at me and said, Pat, he said, if you can concede both propositions, physical, that when you put alcohol into your body, you can't stop and you end up in jail, and that you have a mental obsession that's trying to control and enjoy your drinking without getting you back in consequences, he said, you might be alcoholic. And I'm so grateful he didn't tell me I was an alcoholic. He said, you might be. Because if he would have told me I was an alcoholic, I'd have fought him tooth or nail why I was not an alcoholic and that I was a drug addict. And he looked at me and he said, and I started to cry. I said, Jack, I said, I'm alcoholic, man. He lit up like a chandelier. He's like, all right, I'm going to sponsor you. You know what I mean? I was like, hey, wait, it's a little too fast here, you know? And he gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to give you two directions. The first direction I want you to do is I want you to read that big book. And the second direction is I want you to take a shower. Now, I hadn't taken a shower in 6 months, but I thought, man, how did he know? You know what I mean? And I went to my little room in that detox and I read the big book and I read Bill Wilson and Ticket Tape and Stockbroker. And I don't know what any of this garbage means. And that's what my head said. But I took my first right action. I'm a firm believer my character defect of wanting Jack to like me had me do the things that he wanted me to do. Because I went to the shower and I turned the water on. I fell down on the floor of that detox, man. Just scream out crying in the fetal position, crying, man. And broken on that floor. That guy Jack walked in that detox that day and he got on the floor with me. Put his arms around me and held me down there. He said, kid, it's going to be all right, kid. It's going to be all right, kid. It's going to be all right. I promise you it's going to be all right. He was rubbing my shoulder like this, just rubbing my shoulder. He said, kid, it's going to be all right. And something inside of me, I know it was the power of God. All of a sudden, I turned and I looked at Jack and he looked at me. I looked at him in the eye and he looked right into my soul. He said, kid, he said, I love you, kid. And something shifted. He said, I want you to stand up. And I stood up. He said, I want you to take off your shirt. I took off my shirt. He held onto my arm. He guided me in the shower. He held me underneath the water. And I sit there and I cried because the water hurt my skin. And that man took a washcloth and that man took a bar of soap and that man scrubbed my back. And for the first time in my life, I was 27 years old. For the first time in my life, I felt love from another human being. The same love that I'm continually met with when I walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that unconditional love that we have for one another, was the love that I was given to on day one. And I didn't come to believe in God. I came to believe that you people in Alcoholics Anonymous had a solution here for me. And it was through that unconditional love that that guy showed me that day. I made a decision to turn my will and life over to that guy. By the time I was 90 days sober, I was making amends. And the first amends I made, was to the police department, because I had a warrant. I don't even know how long ago. I think 9:20, I think. I don't know. 9:25. Is anyone going to answer me? And I guess I'll talk till 11. No, just kidding. So, but the first amends that I made that I'll talk about is the amends to my mom. I was 90 days sober. My mom was 27 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom was an active member in Laguna Beach. Man, I love my mom. But 90 days sober, I sat down with my mom and I said, "Mom, I need to make amends to you." On 9:25, I got a text. Thank you. And I said, "Mom, I need to make amends to you, you know. I never went to the hospital any of those times. Never once I went to the hospital. Every time I lied to you, well, some of the times when I wanted to get a job, I really, really was trying to, I really needed clothes and that was what I wanted. But every time I got the money, I could never seem to buy the clothes. It always got other stuff." And I looked at her and I said, "Mom, what can I do to make it right?" And my AA mom said, "All I want you to do is I want you to get in the middle of AA and I want you to help as many people as you can." And she looked at me and she said, "Pat, I want you to know I love you." She called me Patrick. She said, "Patrick, I want you to know I love you." For the first time in my life, 28 years old, I felt love for my mom in that moment. And I ran back to my sponsor. I said, "Man, this AA thing is awesome, man. This is, man, me and my mom healing, man. This is amazing." And I caught fire for Alcoholics Anonymous at 90 days. Man, I was like on fire, you know. I was like, "This is awesome." And I said, "Man, I'm really ready to make the next amends." He said, "Wait a second here." He said, "What about the money?" I said, "Well, she didn't want the money." I said, "All she wanted me to do is get in the middle of AA and help people." He said, "Yeah, but AA wants you to pay it back, you know." And I thought, "Man, I'm never telling this guy anything ever again, you know." He said, "I want you to write a note to your mom once a week that says, 'Mom, I love you and I appreciate you, and I want you to leave her $25. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you, and leave her $25. So every week I'm writing this note. And, you know, I had gotten kicked out of sober living because I went to Coachella and I didn't make it back in time for curfew. And my mom at that time said, "You can move into my house." And so I lived with my mom. And then 6 months in, I had to write a note every day that said, "Mom, I love you and I appreciate you. I hope you have a great day today." And I start writing the notes, but I'm giving her money once a week. And 2 years into this, man, these notes are, I mean, changing, man. I'm like, "You're my hero. You're my best friend. And all of a sudden, like, I'm like having a love affair with my mom, you know, which is kind of weird. I'm 29. I'm like, this is just weird. You know what I mean? And I'm sponsoring guys and I'm active in the program. And I start sponsoring myself. I know that doesn't happen in San Luis Obispo at 2 years, but it happened to me. And I start talking to myself. I'm like, "I'm not writing this note anymore, man. I'm done with this note." And I call my sponsor. I said, "I'm done with this note." And he said, "That's right. You could be done with the note." And I'm like thinking, "Man, I'm off the hook." He said, "But how free do you want to be, Pat?" "I love you and I appreciate you, Dan. I leave her the money, man, because I want to be free, you know." And at 5 years sober, I sat down with my mom at my 5th year birthday. And she said, "I want you to know for the first time in a really long time, I can completely trust you." She gave, you know, and she made me the medical director on her will, which I didn't want to know at 5 years. That's a little too much responsibility, you know. But I didn't know that my mom was going to give me a gift that day. You know, my mom had COPD and she was supposed to wear an oxygen tank, but her pride wouldn't let her wear an oxygen tank. But at her 40 year, right before her 40th year, she was on life support and there's a whole story and I don't have enough time to tell the whole story because I want to talk about the last bit, but what happened was my son went to say goodbye to her on my, she, they took the oxygen because she was, and, uh, my son went to say goodbye, and I literally watched my mom's spirit come out of my mom's body, man. And 2 weeks later, she was off life support. She made it to her 40th AA birthday party. And for the next 3 years, my mom had an oxygen tank, you know. And my mom rocked an oxygen tank like nobody's business, I'll tell you, man. Me and my mom spoke in Canada together on an oxygen tank. We spoke in Nashville. We spoke all over the country together, you know. And but at the end there, my mom, you know, every Monday night I would go see my mom and I'd take, go get my kid and we'd go to dinner and I still bite my nails and my mom would be like, stop biting your nails. You know, man, I'm like, I'm 40 years old. Like, stop treating me like a little kid, you know. And I was talking to my friend Michelle and I said, man, I'm not making this amends anymore every Monday night. I'm done. My mom just beats me up and she just like barks at me. And I said, I'm over this stuff, you know. And Michelle said, Patrick, you're going to have to teach your mom how to love you. And here I am 40 years old. Like, no, my mom should be teaching me like if I'm eight, you know, and I'm a grown man. Like, and so what happened was I started going every Monday and I grabbed my mom on the like by the cheeks and I'd kiss her on the forehead and I'd tell her how much I loved her. And she was like hugging a cactus. I'm about to tell you, she was like, yeah, you know what I mean? I would just love on her and I would call her and just, and we were speaking out of town and we got off the plane and my mom, I was like, mom, just get in the wheelchair. She couldn't breathe. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I'm not getting that goddamn wheelchair. And I said, just get in the wheelchair, mom. I'm not getting in that wheelchair. And she's arguing with me and she'd walk like 5 feet and have to stop because she couldn't breathe. And I looked at her and I said, mom, when are you going to let me love you? I said, we get in the wheelchair. And my mom sat in the wheelchair and something changed, man. And all of a sudden I'm pushing my mom and I'm so proud, push my mom. And I'm an alcoholic. I have alcoholism, not alcoholism, because I got a bright idea that fast. I saw how the walkway started going downhill, and I started running, and I'm going to jump with my feet in the air. My mom's yelling at me, stop, stop, stop. And we hit the hill, and I jump, and the chair's going like this. And we get down the bottom of the hill, and she looks at me, and I'm laughing at her, and something changed. And what happened was our relationship went from a mother-son relationship to an innocent, childlike relationship. And that next morning, I woke up. We were going to go speak, and I woke up in the morning and went to take a shower, and my mom snuck in there the night before, and she put a red dye tablet in the shower head, and I turned the water on, and all this red water came down on me, and I'm like, God dang, you know, I'm like, and I come out, my mom's standing there flipping me off. She goes, I got you, you know, and we started to have fun with one another, you know. And 5 weeks before my mom passed away, on January 10th of last year, my mom passed away. And 5 weeks before, we were at the home group Wednesday night. And my mom would get there at 5 o'clock to make sure that we were all did it right, set up and everything, the meetings at 8. And then my mom would pass the baskets for the first 5 rows. Now, my mom had an oxygen tank, you know what I mean? And she would pass the baskets the first 5 rows. Generally the folks that I sponsor are there, they're usually young guys and they wouldn't have the money, and she would shame them and then flirt with them. And then the next week they go, Patio, I got the money, and they put the money in there. And we heard a speaker that night, and she went home that night, thought she was going to drown, and rushed her to the hospital, and she had a tumor that blocked the passageway, and they cored out the tumor, they diagnosed her with cancer, and they put her on hospice. And I know it's the end. But my mom calls me and she says, I'm only going on hospice to get off hospice. Don't trip, you know. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, my mom was back at the home group, back at her women's meeting, back to Starbucks sponsoring people. And the next week we went to the home group. And that night she went home and she thought she was going to drown. And the tumor had grown that back that fast. And they put her on comfort care. And I said, because the ninth step amends, me and my mom had enough conversations. I knew my mom didn't want to die in the hospital. My mom wanted to die at home. And I looked at the doctor. I said, my mom wants to die at home. And he said, she's not going to make transport. And I looked at the doctor. I said, God's much bigger than you, and I need to honor my mom's word. And we're going to take her at 3 o'clock, and her sats dropped to 20, and the code red or blue or whatever, everyone runs in, and we're staying there, and I'm screaming, I'm crying, no, God, don't let her go, man. And the chaplain's reading the last rites, and right when he's about to say amen, her sats went up to 90, and she's sitting there going, you guys, you know. And the paramedic brought her home, and she was on the stretcher, and as he brought her in, she had her arms up like this, like, I made it. And my mom came in and I had to go speak in Alcoholics Anonymous in Idaho, and I was going to be gone for 5 days. And I'd been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd hear you guys talk about your gift. The greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gave you is that you were there for your loved one when they took their last breath. And I wanted your experience so bad, but I knew I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous to be of service. And so I say a prayer in the morning, and God, what do you want me to do? And the message comes to me, you need to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I don't like that message, so I pray the next day, and the message is, you need to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't like that message, so I pray the next day. And the third day, I call my sponsor. He said, it sounds like you got to go be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to go see my mom, and I kissed her on the forehead. I said, Mom, I'll be back. I went to go be of service. I was gone for 5 days, and the third day, I got a call that said, your mom's non-responsive. You need to hurry up and get back. And I said a prayer, and the message was, you need to be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so scared, man. And I came in on day 5 and got in the, flew in the plane at 9:30 and went straight to my mom's house. My mom was unresponsive for 4 days of that time. And the note didn't talk, didn't move much. And I walked in the door and my mom sat straight up, boom, with her arms up like this. Spirit felt spirit walk in the room that day. And she had her arms up and I went in to give her, grabbed her on the cheeks and I gave her a big kiss on the forehead. I told my mom I loved her and she pulled me in and she said, Pato, I want you to know you did the right thing. She held me. She said, I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. And that was the last words my mom said. And 2 days later, my mom died. Yeah. And my heart broke. But what happened for me in that moment, and I didn't know this for a bit, is that if I would have listened to myself that wanted to sit with my mom for 5 days and watch her sit there and lay there and die and not be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have not honored my mom's word in that ninth step amends. Because all my mom said to me, she said, I want you to stay sober and get in the middle of AA and help as many people as you can. And I did that all the way until my mom died on January 10th of last year. There was a level of forgiveness that happened between my mom and me in that moment. I can't force a surrender and I can't force a forgiveness. But as long as I've continued to take your direction in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been a service. I continue in 11-step discipline. The 10th-step promise says that I've entered the world of the Spirit. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, that I have entered the world of the Spirit, that what I need to do is I need to heal spiritually. And I'll continue to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I promised my mom before I died I'd continue to carry her legacy. I thank you for allowing me to be a service. I thank you for allowing the healing process to continue tonight, and I love you all. Thanks.
Oh my gosh.